From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week in Redwood City, California, the case was closed on a national obsession. The jury of Scott Peterson's peers recommended a sentence of death, having found him guilty of the first-degree murder of his wife and the second-degree murder of the fetus she carried. Or, as the media put it,
Peterson faces the death penalty or life in prison for the murders of his wife, Lacey, and unborn son, Connor.
An emotional effort to convince jurors that Peterson deserves the death penalty for the murders of his wife, Lacey, and their unborn son, Connor.
He did what he did. Killed not only his wife, but his unborn child.
Earlier this year, Congress passed the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, otherwise known as Lacey and Connor's Law. And it seems news outlets are changing their terminology to match. Stories about the Peterson verdict in the Washington Post and the New York Times referred to both the fetus and the unborn child. The Chicago Tribune stuck with fetus, but not for long. In the first revision of the Tribune style book since 1989, fetus will no longer refer to what a woman carries in her third trimester. That is to be called an unborn child.
The anti-abortion group Concerned Women for America took note of what it called an ironic double standard. The group observed that when Scott Peterson kills, he murders an unborn child. But if a woman ends her pregnancy, she aborts a fetus. Connor was technically a fetus. We asked Chicago Tribune public editor Don Wycliffe and deputy managing editor Randy Weissman why his paper will no longer apply that word in the third trimester. Randy says he began with research.
I actually made some calls. We checked with medical people, and the feeling was that, yes, pretty much any fetus in the third trimester was going to be a viable fetus. Now, is that a recent change? Not really, but I think the consensus has grown. I mean, fetuses of 5 months right now are being saved and are living.
According to Merriam-Webster, fetus would have served just as well. Fetus is defined as an unborn or unhatched vertebrate, especially after attaining the basic structural plan of its kind, specifically a developing human from usually 3 months after conception to birth. I mean, you are safe as houses with that.
You're safe, but you're not reflecting the state of the language in society today. I might add that Roe v. Wade was not a decision that said the fetus or unborn child has no rights as a being. It said that the rights of the child as a dependent being cannot outweigh the right to liberty of the mother. Normally, by the third trimester, one can assume that the mother intends to have this child in most cases. And therefore, we are recognizing that in her view, most often, the child is an unborn child, not just a fetus any longer.
One other thing that we clearly took into account was also the legal issues. The courts have started to recognize the human status in many instances. The Scott Peterson case in and of itself was not necessarily the changing point, but what it did point out was that a court could charge a person with murder of an unborn being. And that kind of progression within the legal system has forced changes in a lot of different things, but certainly in our style and how we approach that.
Surely you know that you're entering a very dicey area by starting to refer to some fetuses as children. You haven't avoided a debate. You've walked squarely into it.
We're going to be in a debate no matter what we choose. And what we're trying to do is reflect the state of the language and medicine and law in the society.
What clued you in that it was time to adjust the language?
This process of revising the style book began over 18 months ago. We took the old style book and went through it entry by entry by entry to say, does this need change? The term fetus was one of hundreds that were changed. So the decision was made before Scott Peterson even killed his wife, or the discussion was in place at any rate.
You said that you went through the style book entry by entry. Can you talk a little about the other linguistic quagmires that you fell into in the process of updating it? For instance, what's a terrorist?
Funny you should mention that. Our approach is to describe the actions of the individuals involved in so-called terrorist incidents. So if they hijack a plane, we call them a hijacker. If they murder somebody, we call them a killer. And we leave to the individual reader to decide whether they think it's a terrorist or not. I'll be frank, I don't think I've gotten more mail about anything than terrorist over the last few years. That's a persistent source of upset to a lot of people.
I wouldn't be surprised if in the future you get quite a bit of reaction to the replacing of fetus with unborn child. It's the words that you use that change the way a debate is framed.
And the words are a key, and that's why we at the Tribune reflect language as if it's a living thing. And as the applications and definitions change and evolve, it's our responsibility to try to make those words more accurate and more applicable. Just because they're controversial does not make them less accurate.
Randy Weissman is Deputy Managing Editor for Operations at the Chicago Tribune, and Don Wycliffe is the paper's public editor. Thank you both very much.
Certainly. Glad we could help.
In politics and morality, whoever controls the terminology controls the debate. George Lakoff, professor of linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, and a prominent Democratic political strategist, says that the change in the Tribune style book proves yet again that conservatives have won the war of words.
They create a term, and they use it over and over and over again, until it sounds like it's the normal term. It's a step down the slippery slope of getting rid of abortions. And there's no corresponding voice from progressives to stop them.
You talk a lot about framing debates. The abortion issue that we've just discussed has thus been, in your view, effectively framed by the anti-abortion advocates. Can you describe what you mean by that?
The general idea is this. Each word, any word like table, is defined with respect to a frame that says you have a flat surface that's supported on the bottom and that you can put things on the flat surface. If, however, you take another word, take the word relief, mm-hmm. that says that there's some affliction, and a reliever who's a hero who takes the affliction away. Now, if you add tax to get tax relief, you get a metaphor, taxation as an affliction, and that says we should get rid of all taxes because we should get rid of all afflictions. Now, even the term abortion is a question of framing. Take the word abort, as in abort the mission. Okay, mm-hmm. That means that something good has been stopped. If you talked about ending an unwanted pregnancy, that's a different issue.
Right. Now, you say that conservatives have had in the war of language a huge success and that it's been the product of decades of hard work.
Well, it's not just hard work. It's also the investment of over $3 billion. For 35 years, conservatives have been following a plan laid out by Lewis Powell in 1971 to build a system of institutions to generate articles, books, ideas, and language, and then to put those into the public consciousness. There are now 80 institutions that are part of this message machine. They cost about $400 million a year. The liberals are 35 years and many thousands of people behind.
But what happened 35 years ago? Surely back then progressives could have counted a few victories in their column. The phrase, for instance, affirmative action.
Yeah. Well, what happens is that there are a couple here and there, like affirmative action. If you start making a list, it ends pretty quickly. You know, the Endangered Species Act, I think, was one. But you have to go back, I don't know, 25 years to find them.
Well, affirmative action got replaced in recent years with quotas, which, of course, is not something any of us is going to like.
Well, its quotas are exactly the right-wing conscious attempt to replace affirmative action.
You have said in what you've written that it doesn't matter if you present people with the facts. If the facts don't fit into the frame, they simply drop out the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, if facts are secondary to framing, where does that leave the whole enterprise of journalism?
It leaves it in a position of great responsibility and importance. It's not that there are no facts. There are facts. But for people to make sense of those facts, to make sense, for example, that there was a systematic program of torture carried out by the U.S. military. That's not something that fits the understanding of the United States military. It's not something that people are ready to accept. It doesn't fit their frame. Now, in order to be able to tell the truth, you can't just say the truth. You have to have a set of frames in which the truth can be fit and understood. The responsibility of the media is to understand what framing is.
Let me ask you this finally. Is fetus a more neutral term than unborn child, or is it simply a more liberal term? And when dealing with any moral issue, and most political issues are moral issues, is there such a thing as neutral language that a journalist can use, or do they have to choose sides?
Well, first of all, fetus is a technical term, but the term fetus in a context can become politically charged. Similarly, the word child, which used to be a perfectly normal everyday word, has now become a political term. So it's not the word itself, but it's the context that you're in. There is no objective answer to the question, when does life begin? That is something that only has to do with framing.
Is it up to the media then to dodge the frames or to acknowledge them?
To acknowledge them. There's no way to dodge them. You have to be able to create a discourse in which you talk about the way things are framed and why that matters. So the Chicago Tribune, when they have their thing that says unborn child, it should say, you know, a right-wing term corresponding to fetus.
That'll happen. George, thank you very much.
Okay.
George Lakoff is a professor of linguistics at UC Berkeley and the author of, most recently, Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate.
Coming up, a case study in why people hate the media, and a reality show that votes amateur diplomats off the island.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, The Washington Post gave page one treatment to a story about journalism gone wrong when a man's career and family suffered grievous harm as a result of trial by media. The man in question, according to a piece by Alicia Mundy, is a Massachusetts superior judge who reportedly said of a 14-year-old rape victim, "Tell her to get over it." The Boston Herald reporter who put this quote in the judge's mouth is Dave Wedge. Wedge even went on national television to repeat and confirm the quote, "Tell her to get over it."
Well, it turns out that what the judge actually said was close, but had an entirely different meaning, one that suggests he wanted the victim to be able to get through it and move on with her life eventually. But the trial by media was already over, and the judge had already lost. In an internet chat room, someone wrote that justice would be served if the judge's five daughters were raped, and one posting said, quote, "Publish his street address and then tell him to get over it." His frightened daughters briefly moved out of the house. Their mother says their schoolwork has suffered. They've experienced crying jags and nightmares. The judge has sued the Boston Herald for libel, and the case will be heard by a jury next month. Reporter Alicia Mundy, who has since joined the Seattle Times as Washington correspondent, joins me now with her own reporting on the story. Alicia, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with just a little tutorial on libel law. The judge in this case is a public figure, and therefore the threshold of a libel finding is quite high. Can you explain what a court would have to find?
What the court has to find is something called actual malice, which means that there has to be a reckless disregard for the truth. That's a higher standard when you're involved with a public official. It's not enough just to be wrong. You have to have shown that the reporter had reason to believe that they might not have all their facts right.
Well, let's talk about the quote, because there's a great difference, as Mark Twain observed, between lightning and a lightning bug. And I suppose there's a great difference between tell her to get over it, and she's got to get over it. Can you give me a little context here?
The day after the sentencing, there was a closed conference in the judge's chambers, and no notes are taken during those conferences. And it's during this time that there was allegedly some discussion between the judge and one of the prosecutors about the previous day's rape case. And the judge is supposed to have said, she's 14. She can't go through life as a victim. She's got to get over it. Somehow that became, tell her to get over it. And the response, of course, from everybody in Boston, I think we can safely say everybody there, was, quite strong. That is a pretty demeaning comment, if that comment was made.
So we have a crusading tabloid that has printed 17 stories, all triggered by apparently some misreporting. But still probably not enough to prove libel against a news organization, since a public official is involved. But then the reporter of the original story, Dave Wedge, went on to the O'Reilly Factor on Fox News Channel, and the situation kind of changed. What happened?
On the O'Reilly Factor, Bill O'Reilly actually said, I believe, are you 100% sure that Judge Murphy said the rape victim should get over it? And Dave Wedge answered, yes, he made this comment to three lawyers. He knows he said it. And everybody else that knows this judge knows that he said it. That's a pretty strong comment. And in the end, as it turns out from depositions, Dave Wedge has acknowledged under oath that, in fact, he only talked to one person who said he heard the judge say anything. And that person, a district attorney, has said under oath that Mr. Wedge got the quote wrong. I think where the issue becomes very interesting for trying to prove reckless disregard for the truth is that a few months after this, the reporter gave a deposition in which he repeatedly said, I don't know or I can't recall. And you contrast this with the statements on O'Reilly, where he seems so certain. And I think this is where the lawyers for the judge feel that they've had their opening.
Let's just say, Alicia, that a jury finds that Judge Murphy was indeed libeled by the Boston Herald, not only on the strength of the repeated errors in the newspapers, but based on Dave Wedge's own misstatements on the O'Reilly Factor. These are the days when you can't turn on a television anymore without seeing some reporter on some 24-hour cable news show promoting his own story in one way or another. What news organization will ever let one of its reporters out of the building to go on television if this case results in a libel verdict?
I think you can let your reporters out of the building. I think it helps if what they're walking out of the building with is a story that is as accurate as it can be. I know of at least two national newspapers who had meetings this week between their libel lawyers and editors on this very issue, trying to set up guidelines that would help reporters go on the air, promote their stories, promote the newspapers, and not cause major problems or not add to problems that are there. Yes, this could be a very interesting area for libel law to get into, and it could be a real problem.
Let me ask you one more question. Alicia, you've written a story in the Washington Post. Now you're coming on our show to talk about it. Are you absolutely sure? Absolutely sure of everything you've told me today?
I am sitting in this booth with a pile of documents and depositions that's 4 inches high. This may be the slowest I've spoken in my entire life.
Alicia, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Alicia Mundy is the newly appointed Washington correspondent for the Seattle Times. Her story about the Boston Herald libel case appeared in the Washington Post. Mordecai Vanunu, a former Israeli nuclear technician, is, as of Wednesday, the new rector of Glasgow University, an honorary position the student body has previously bestowed upon Winnie Mandela. But his real position is in an Israeli prison serving time. In 1986, Vanunu went public with evidence that Israel had developed a comprehensive nuclear weapons program, something Israel has never admitted. London's Sunday Times broke the story, and 3 weeks later, Vanunu was lured to Italy by an Israeli spy and captured. He served the next 18 years in an Israeli prison. In April of this year, Vanunu was released under a few conditions, one being that he not speak to any foreign press. But he did so almost immediately, and with such regularity that he was rearrested this fall. Yoel Cohen is the author of The Whistleblower of Dimona about Vanunu, and he joins us now from Jerusalem. Yoel, welcome to the show.
Hello.
In reading some interviews I've seen of Vanunu, he strikes me as being strangely naive, you know, maybe a doctorate holder in philosophy, and yet almost clueless about the ways of the real world. Is that your impression as well?
Yes, it is. He really felt that once he spoke to the Sunday Times, Israel would subsequently come out and confirm what it had. And he was rather disappointed about the reaction of the international community, which was even repeated once he was released early this year in April, because he thought that the international community would welcome him, and his request to get citizenship in other countries has failed.
He was trying to be a Karen Silkwood, but found that he wasn't met entirely with sympathy by Israelis or the world at large.
In Israel itself, he was seen as a traitor, both at the governmental level and at the popular level. There's a broad consensus, not only on the right, but also on the left in Israel, in favor of Israel possessing a nuclear capability, which during the years Vanunu was in prison, has only increased.
Let's say that the punishment for Vanunu, who, after all, was acting out of principle, was disproportionate to the crime. Let's just say that for a moment. What culpability do you believe that the Times of London has in this? They certainly didn't do a very good job of protecting the man.
The Sunday Times, to be fair, claims that Vanunu himself didn't cooperate entirely with the paper and warned Vanunu not to go away with a lady who turned out to be a Mossad agent involved in abducting him. At the same time, Vanunu offered the Sunday Times the story with a wish that his name not be disclosed in order to protect him. But the Sunday Times came back and insisted that we have to use your name because you're the witness. The story was much stronger because they were able to identify who it was. But Vanunu paid a very, very high price of 18 years imprisonment.
Now, here in the United States in the mid-80s, there was the case of Samuel Morrison, who was a defense analyst and used a photograph that he obtained at work and had it printed in Jane's Defense Weekly. And he ended up prosecuted and imprisoned for espionage. There wasn't a whole lot of squawking about that.
But he didn't get anywhere near the 18 years imprisonment. Basically, the Israeli legal system does not have a law prosecuting somebody for disclosing classified information to the media. And so the judicial system basically had to pull the existing laws on espionage and treason to fit the Vanunu case.
Now, you've said that the Israeli people, even those arrayed on the left, believe that the government should have locked Vanunu up and thrown away the key. But what about the Israeli press, which is widely regarded as being fiercely independent? What was and is their reaction to Vanunu's sentence and to his current predicament?
In 1986, the Israeli press was no different from anybody else in Israel in perceiving Vanunu as a traitor. In fact, they didn't want to be identified with Vanunu, even though they did take this first and only opportunity to reprint and translate into Hebrew the entire three-page article which appears in the Sunday Times. And even though they want more and more information about nuclear matters and are critical of the excessive censorship, they don't think it was justified for Vanunu to disclose the intimate operational details.
Finally, you've spent a lot of time thinking and writing about Mordecai Vanunu. From your perspective, is he a hero? Is he a traitor? Or is he just, to borrow a word from Yiddish, just a schlemiel?
He may be a little simplistic. He's certainly politically naive. But he seemed to have identified a hole in what is claimed to be a thriving democracy. And I suspect that the more he's not allowed to have his full freedom to go out of the country, the more he's going to become, rightly or wrongly, an important figurehead abroad.
Well, Professor Cohen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yoel Cohen is the author of The Whistleblower of Dimona and is a senior lecturer at Netanya College in Netanya between Haifa and Tel Aviv.
Last month, an Israeli television network premiered The Ambassador, a reality show where contestants act as spokespeople for the Israeli government. Modeled after The Apprentice, 14 contestants travel to the United States, France, Britain, and Israel to debate each other, answer questions from the public, and promote Israeli policy. The winner will be determined by three judges and will receive a year's contract with an Israeli advocacy group in the U.S. Nachman Shai is one of those judges. He's a former Israeli military spokesperson, and he joins me now from Jerusalem. Mr. Shai, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
Okay, now the first person voted off was a member of the women's team. I guess there is a men's and a women's team. And she responded to a question by answering, "Let me make it clear that Israel has not taken anything from anyone." And she was basically laughed off the stage. Where did this happen?
The first contest happened in Cambridge University in near London, where they came to debate in front of a few hundred students and faculty. Unfortunately, the men won. I'm saying unfortunately because the men won so far three times, which makes me upset. I give more credit to Israeli women, but this is the outcome so far. Anyhow, she made a terrible mistake. This was really something that I wouldn't expect any representative of Israel to say. Yes, we did took some lands, and we are ready to return them and for a certain security to Israel and so on and so forth. And yes, she was out of the program, and we are continuing.
Now, you say the men's team and the women's team debate each other, but they also take questions from, in this case, they took questions from Cambridge University students who were presumably not all that sympathetic to the Israeli cause.
Oh, yeah, I'm not surprised. We know where London and Britain stand these days. But yes, we have to face that and to fight back in this front and not to lose it. Be careful not to lose, because for us, as a small country, public opinion is extremely important.
But do you think a survivor-type format is the way to deal with what is widely perceived to be a huge national public relations problem?
We want to find out what is the problem. Are we just bad at our PR, or there is something deeper? Maybe we have to look at what we are doing and what mistakes we made in the past, and how can we change it in the future? So it's not the format as much as the content. This is an internal discussion between us Israelis. Why don't we use television as a tool to talk to ourselves?
You make a fascinating point that the problem may not be one of perception. It may be one of policy. It seems that your program is engaged in a non-official public relations enterprise well below government circles where policy might be formulated or changed. What does the government think of what you're doing? And do you think they'll take any cues from what happens?
I'm not sure the government cares very much. This is an independent television network. But at the same time, I believe that every Israeli, we travel abroad a lot because we cannot travel around our borders. We become a kind of ambassadors for the state of Israel, and we are engaged wherever we are with questions and issues relating to Israel. And so I think that the government, in a way, has an interest in that, to make the Israelis aware of how tough it is to explain to others what we are doing and why we are doing. And we have to work very hard to convince you and others that we are truly defending ourselves in this terrible situation, which has been around for almost 4 years.
Isn't it hard to do? Diplomacy requires a single message, but there's a great range of opinion within Israel. How do your contestants convey one message, or do they not even try?
This is part of the show, and this is what makes this television program such a big success. But at the end of the day, there is official policy of this country, and we don't force them to take a certain line. They decide what to say and what to do and how to show it. And yes, you'll be surprised that almost 25 French decided to come to Israel now.
Because of the program?
Yes, yes, yes. Those the men against the women, they were competing on Champs-Élysées in a very rainy day, trying to convince French people just passing by to come to a certain shop where they were selling them package trips to Israel.
So you think you won some hearts and minds there. What about at Cambridge University? I mean, did it encourage the Cambridge students to change their minds about Israel?
I don't know. I wouldn't say that 7 minutes speech, even carried by Winston Churchill, will convince British citizens or audience at this stage that Israel is right. But I would say that it may penetrate some minds and hearts, and maybe a longer speech next time will do the job.
I'm sure you're familiar with the article in the very influential Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which basically said this program, the ambassador, is an embarrassing and even pathetic enterprise.
So, I am also familiar with what another newspaper by the name New York Times said about the program. So I compare, when I compare the New York Times and Haaretz, maybe for a change I will select New York Times as my favorite newspaper.
Did you agree with any of it? Did you think he made a good case when he said this is not how Israel should be presenting itself around the world?
One of the characteristics of the Israeli people is that we are very, very critical of ourselves. We don't give ourselves a minute of rest. And if we can attack ourselves and our leaders as well, we do it with a lot of pleasure.
Mr. Shai, thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Thank you very much.
Nachman Shai is one of the judges of the ambassador. He's also a former Israeli military spokesperson and current senior vice president of United Jewish Communities.
Up next, how National Geographic reacted to fascist and revolting caterpillars, and why for some a struggling French newspaper portends the defeat of the Enlightenment.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Newspapers all over the world are in crisis. Readership down, newsprint costs up, and worse, the young don't read papers. It's the neurotic cliché of every newspaper editor in the Western world. But now the crisis, or as they like to say in France, la crise, has come to one of the world's great journalistic standard bearers, Le Monde, which in English means the world. But the decline of Le Monde touches something a little deeper than hard times. As Frank Browning reports from Paris, or as the French like to say, Paris, it may also mark the end of an era in the nation where the Enlightenment was born.
If you want to know what's wrong with Le Monde, you could start here some morning at the Café Descartes, named for the father of the French Enlightenment. Four daily French papers, plus the Herald Tribune, are dutifully laid out each morning for the clients, but only a few customers bother with them. Josette, who cooks and serves at the Descartes, remembers how it used to be.
In the old days, everybody came and started off the day talking about what they'd read in the paper and arguing about politics.
Now the men and women standing at the bar with their espressos talk about last night's reality TV show or who screwed up in the latest soccer contest. But in the old days, of all the French dailies, there was one that counted for more than all the rest. That was Le Monde, founded at the behest of General de Gaulle just after France's liberation in 1944. American journalist William Pfaff has spent most of his life working in Paris.
It was supposed to be the conscience of the state. A conscience, an arbitrary conscience, with which you might argue, but one whose impartiality or whose integrity was not to be challenged.
Or, as author and media critic Bernard Poulet puts it,
Le Monde wanted to be what they call a journal de référence, which means the journal you can trust completely, where all the news are perfectly exact. That was Le Monde, and with some arrogance, kind of conviction, they were the best.
Not just the newspaper of record, as the New York Times considers itself, but the journal of reference, the paper to which all educated, enlightened people must refer in the ceaseless debates about politics and society that has been the hallmark of Frenchness since, well, you might say, since the birth of the Enlightenment. And its role, as reflected in its name, the world, was not only to be restricted to France.
When you had to know something or to think about something, you had to refer to Le Monde. During many, many years, there was no possibility to compare Le Monde to any other newspaper in any country. in New York Times in the United States, the Times during many years in Britain, El País now in Spain, or Frankfurt Allgemeine, were good newspapers, but Le Monde was different.
The mystique of Le Monde did waft its way around the world, in part because it dared to post phalanxes of correspondents all around the world, and in part because it cast a fiercely independent outlook. On American college campuses, it, or its English language weekly version, was heralded for the depth of its reportage on China and Vietnam. Its reporters, many of whom had cut their teeth on France's own war in Indochina, wrote big books that were assigned in college classes. And truth be told, newly jet-setting American students of the late 60s found they could earn a certain cachet by carrying around and citing the famous little tabloid with the tiny typeface.
I was very struck when I first came to France.
Foreign affairs writer William Pfaff.
By the fact that Le Monde would publish a businessman's opinion piece, starting it on the front page, continuing it on the interior. It would publish an artist's views on some large public issue. It was open in a way that the well, let me put it this way. It was Le Monde, but it was also that the French debate.
While the paper's front page was given over to a wide ideological array of debaters, they all had something very much in common. They tended to come from a tiny elite who had been trained in what are called les grandes écoles, very tough schools, many first established by Napoleon, that might make Harvard and Yale almost seem like community colleges.
These grandes écoles produced the philosophers, but also the civil servants and also the politicians. And so they all talked to one another with a certain equality. They all felt that they had something to say, and they did their talking in Le Monde.
This post-war generation of technocrats and intellectuals saw the rebuilding of France as a collective mission. And Le Monde, with the news discreetly wrapped into these master debates, was central to that mission, says Bernard Poulet.
This period finished, well, many years ago, around the years 70, 80s. And certainly we don't need that kind of newspaper who thinks it has a mission of reconstructing the moral and technical elements of this nation. This mission is finished.
Despite its plunging circulation, now less than 400,000 in a country of 60 million, and its scant ads were never very strong in the paper and were often considered to be in bad taste, few believe Le Monde will actually disappear. The real question is the one posed by Bernard Poulet. What should be the mission for this once great newspaper? Le Monde's current editors, who took over a decade ago during the paper's last financial panic, tried to move toward breaking news, publishing scoops about its government enemies, and running soft stories on Princess Di and reality TV on the cover. But as columnist William Pfaff notes, the bookkeeper's ink still ran red.
I would say the contemporary decline of Le Monde began at the point when it started publishing news. They tried to make it more of a newspaper of the kind that's published abroad, and it would seem that this has not worked particularly well.
The one upbeat note is that Le Monde's worldwide online edition is growing rapidly, more than 12 million hits a month. But so far, online revenue doesn't begin to cover even its own operational costs. For On the Media, I'm Frank Browning in Paris.
Now for a few of your letters. We received one from Lee Pitts Sr., the father of Lee Pitts, the Chattanooga Times Free Press reporter, now embedded with U.S. troops in Iraq. Last week, the reporter caused a stir when he worked with a soldier on a tough question to put to Donald Rumsfeld about the lack of armor for Humvees. Pitts' participation was exposed when a private email he sent to a colleague went public.
His father writes, "I thank you for your unbiased assessment of the problem. Seems it has been a classic case of shoot the messenger with all the focus and hate email regarding my son's actions. He's been accused of everything from being a liberal left-wing commie to a new Dan Rather. Actually, the emails are running about 5-1 in favor of his effort to reveal the problem to the country. Lee was in convoy during the time the story broke and did not learn of the firestorm until late Friday night our time. He was, of course, shocked and dismayed at all the attention and hated that he had not been able to defend himself. Funny how a private email addressed mostly to friends and family turns up a tipping point in the international media.
And we received this from Daniel Levitis of Berkeley, California. You recently featured a discussion of what to call the religious conservative voting bloc, formerly known as the religious right. There's a long-standing term found in most dictionaries for those who wish to base government policy on the views of religious leaders, theocrats. Perhaps evangelical theocrats would best communicate exactly who we mean.
But several listeners objected to the use of the word evangelical to indicate a conservative agenda. According to Michael Miller of LaGrange Park, Illinois, quote, evangelical means derived from the gospel. Many Christians who are often referred to as evangelicals define their Christianity as, quote, accepting Jesus as their personal savior, an expression found neither in the gospels or the rest of the New Testament. And he says that, quote, most members of the evangelical Lutheran Church in America would not be considered part of the religious right.
Whatever you call yourself, tell us how to pronounce it and the city you're writing from and send it to onthemedia@wnyc.org.
National Geographic magazine has long captured the imaginations of lay scientists who have never personally tracked wild Bengal tigers or studied Neanderthal language patterns. But thanks to the magazine and its Cambodian Buddhist temples, early human remains, and caterpillars that can fire their feces at a rate of 4.3 feet per second, these things have never been so accessible to the common man. In his new book, Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made, Robert M. Poole chronicles the magazine's 120-year journey from uncertain patrimonial undertaking to glossy commercial success. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke. Happy to be here.
Could you give me first a quick sketch of the founder of the National Geographic Society?
Actually, there were 33 founders, but the main one we are interested in this book is Gardner Green Hubbard. He was a Yankee blue blood, a Boston lawyer, an entrepreneur, an early officer of the Boston Rubber Shoe Company.
And so this man of all business moved to Washington. He had a great interest in science, and he created this local society.
Originally, the National Geographic Society was just sort of a small club, people sitting around talking to each other. And when they thought of it, they would publish a magazine.
Then Hubbard died, and his son-in-law was chosen to run the magazine. I can't quite recall his name.
I believe it was Alexander Graham Bell.
That was it. Tell me about his impact on the magazine.
Bell was the brilliant inventor. He couldn't focus on anything for more than 4 seconds. He was just spinning out ideas all the time. The main novelty he seized on was photography. It had been around for quite a few years, but it wasn't very broadly seen by the reading public. Most of the magazines of the day were just words, and Bell had the idea, let's do words and pictures.
Let's talk about National Geographic's great gimmick. You weren't buying a magazine when you were buying National Geographic. You were buying entry into the society.
It was a gimmick, but it was also genuine in a way. It was, and still is today, a membership organization so that all the money that comes in goes back into operations so that the magazine could afford to send writers and photographers out into the field for a long time and spend a lot of money on ink, printing, you know, the high production values that people associate with the Geographic.
And as far as you can tell, only one member was ever expelled. I think he was serving time at Leavenworth when he was booted off the rolls.
Yes, this was a gentleman from Chicago named Al Capone. He was a faithful member of the National Geographic Society for many years. He got into some difficulty in 1932, and they struck him off the membership list. But they were nice enough to let him become
keep his
a subscriber
subscription.
for an extra 25 cents a year, so.
Of course, some people were discouraged from signing up altogether.
Yes. Through most of the 20th century, you would not have seen many people of color at the lectures or at the in the library that National Geographic maintains for Washington area members. Washington itself was, in effect, segregated until the 1940s. The people who ran National Geographic didn't want black members showing up and attending lectures. They thought it might embarrass the loyal white members. And this really didn't end until the late 50s, early 60s.
Do you think that this unenlightened perspective of the National Geographic at the time was reflected in all the coverage that it did of foreign cultures? One issue you don't address at length is the criticism that has for years been leveled at National Geographic that its explicit representations of non-Northern peoples can seem racist. Or to put it another way, perhaps, there were a lot of brown breasts made available for educational purposes to teenage boys everywhere, but it seemed rather as if they were being put in a class of non-humans.
I think that's a valid criticism, and I think that there was a strong element of that in National Geographic for many years, for most of the 20th century. I do think it began to change in the 60s and 70s when a newer generation began to take over for the older one. But it was slow to change.
One of the magazine's earliest credos was something on the order of, if you can't say something nice about a place or a person, then don't say it at all, which is pretty strange for any periodical, including, you know, Modern Bride. But it seemed to fit the times, I guess.
Well, go back to Alexander Graham Bell. I think that was his attitude, and I think he passed it on to his son-in-law, Gilbert Grosvenor. They were reacting to the nastiness of the daily press, yellow journalism. Bell had a sort of high-minded optimism that he somehow managed to get into the genetic material of National Geographic. Bell thought the world was a beautiful place, and he wanted the magazine to celebrate that. This approach to journalism, if you want to call it journalism, got him in trouble as the grim realities of the 20th century began to set in.
Right. One place the magazine resolutely declined to criticize was Germany in the early days of Hitler.
Yes. This is one of the most embarrassing moments in the National Geographic's history. A very engaging, very charming fellow named Douglas Chandler wrote a glowing piece in 1937 about Berlin, which must be described as a pro-Nazi story. National Geographic published it. They didn't see any problem with it. Until the United States entered the war, Douglas Chandler remained in Germany and began broadcasting for Nazi radio.
Well, later the National Geographic made amends by offering both information to the FBI and a box seat from which to spy on the Soviet embassy that was located right next door.
Yes, National Geographic didn't really draw a very fine line between media and government. And in the 60s, National Geographic provided an office in its 16th Street headquarters building for the FBI to keep an eye on the Soviet embassy across the street. There were two guys in dark suits who came and went at all hours, kept the door locked, and on the door was the name the Mid-Atlantic Research Committee.
You spent much of your professional life at National Geographic, and there was a time when you were executive editor, and it wasn't a short time. How does your tenure fit into the history of that magazine?
I don't know what to say about my role there, except that I came in the early 80s, and my primary role was to make the writing as good as the photography. But it was sort of like being a word guy at Playboy magazine. Nobody ever really noticed.
Thank you very, very much.
Brooke, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Robert M. Poole is author of Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Jamie York, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keith is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff and Madeline Baer. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media, produced by WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And Women's E-News, news every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy, at womensenews.org. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR, National Public Radio.